welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is producer, songwriter, composer Michael Carey. First of all, Michael Jackson's Thriller was just certified at 33 times platinum in the United States. That means 33 million copies. Supposedly, Thriller has sold 105 million copies worldwide, although you can never really tell on those figures, but it's probably not that far off. Now, all told, Michael Jackson has sold more than a billion records total worldwide. Again, you can never really tell about that number, but it sounds pretty good. It's interesting to actually look at the top 10 best-selling albums because there are some surprises there. Number two, for instance, is the Eagles' Greatest Hits at 29 million. Number three was a surprise to me. It's Billy Joel's Greatest Hits at 23 million. Number four was Led Zeppelin IV at 23 million. Number five, Pink Floyd The Wall, also at 23 million. Number six was AC/DC's Back in Black at 22 million. Number seven, also a surprise, Garth Brooks' Double Live at 21 million. Number eight, Fleetwood Mac's Rumors at 20. Number nine, also a surprise to me anyway, Shania Twain's Come On Over, 20 million. And number 10, The Beatles' White Album at 19 million. That one's always a surprise because you expect Abbey Road to be the big seller, and it really wasn't. It was a big seller, but certainly not like the White Album. Now, what's interesting, if you look at the top 50 best-selling albums of all time, there are a number of artists that are on there two or three times. So, for instance, Garth Brooks is on there twice, the Beatles are on three times, Whitney Houston, who I wouldn't have expected, is on there twice, Shania Twain is also on there twice, Led Zeppelin three times, Pink Floyd twice, the Backstreet Boys are on a couple of times, never would have thought about that, and Bruce Springsteen also a couple of times. Now, the thing about these sales is the fact that we will never see sales like this again, unless, of course, the music industry comes out with a new product that people want to buy. But that's not looking good these days. There's nothing on the horizon. And people are used to getting their music sort of for free. Streaming isn't exactly free. In some cases it is, in some cases it isn't, but it feels like it costs a lot less than it ever has, and that's probably the case. So anyway, it's interesting to look at these numbers and kind of respect them because in many cases, the people that show up on the list are sort of surprising sometimes. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. The fourth editions of my Mixing Engineer's Handbook, Recording Engineer's Handbook, and Mastering Engineer's Handbook are now available on Amazon and soon coming to a bookstore near you. You can read excerpts and find out more details by going to bobbyosinski.com. Now, earlier in the week, I posted my latest top 10 favorite compressors, and I got a fair amount of email asking me some questions, and it's mostly, why did you pick that and not this? So let me just give you a quick explanation here, and we'll go over these. It's a little easier to talk about it than it is to write it sometimes. So the first one, number one, my favorite compressor, would be the 1176. Why? Well, because it kind of works on everything if you really want it to. So you can use it in just about every case. Is it perfect for every case? No. But is it workable? Yeah, you bet. It's fast enough to work when you need it to work as a limiter. You can set it slow enough so it's a really nice gentle compressor. You can make it aggressive sounding, and you can make it over the top aggressive sounding with the nuke setting. But for the most part, it just sits there and works really well. Number two is the LA-2A, which, boy, I think that's high up on everybody's list. Once again, when it comes to a nice, gentle compressor that can really sound very aggressive if you wanted to, this is the one. And again, on vocals, it seems to work great, but, you know, I have great luck with it on hi-hat, and who would believe that? Number three is the LA-3A, and this is my favorite compressor for guitars, either acoustic or electric. There's something about the way it works on these instruments, the way it works on the transients, that it just makes everything sit better in the mix, even if you don't use that much, even if it's hardly deflecting and there's only a dB or two of compression. It just makes it work better for some reason. Number four on the list for me is the UAD Precision Limiter, and of course, you have to be a Universal Audio owner, You have to own the hardware, either an Apollo or one of their satellites, in order to be able to get this. But as far as a limiter, and I'm talking about a brick wall limiter that you can strap across your bus and make sure that it never peaks, this is it. And again, I usually set it so it hardly does anything except take care of those peaks. And it does so in a way where you can hardly hear it. Now, a lot of times people really want to hear it, and you can set it up that way. But if you want a nice transparent limiter, this is it. Number five is the PSP Vintage Warmer, which I don't think this will be on a lot of lists, and maybe it should be. This, again, is one of those compressors that just sounds great sitting in the bus without doing anything. And I always put this first in my mix bus. Why? It adds a glue. There's just something to it. And again, it hardly does anything. Maybe there's a dB or 2 dB at the most that's actually contributing in the way of gain reduction. But as far as I'm concerned, it just makes everything sound better. So it's always there, every single mix I do. Number six is the SSL bus compressor, and that's much the same thing. There's something about this SSL bus compressor that always works. I remember going into the studio, I don't remember which one, and it was marked as the good button. And this is on an SSL console on a 4K. Why was it the good button? Well, it always makes it sound good. Really hard to make a mix sound bad, kind of regardless how you're hitting it. That being said, those three in combination are pretty standard for me. So in other words, it would be the vintage limiter first into the SSL bus compressor into the UAD precision limiter. And I just find that that combination sounds great. Occasionally, I'll put a Fairchild in there as well. But for some reason, that combination just works for me. Number seven is a newcomer on the list. It's the JST Finality. And it's a limiter that's kind of built around FET limiters, kind of like an 1176. And it sort of looks like it, and it sort of acts like it, but they go one step better. Joey Sturgis is a really clever guy, and he's a great engineer and producer as well. So he kind of made this for himself. But boy, it really works great on drums. There's a color button on it, an aggro button, that just makes the kick and snare just lift out of a mix, makes it sound better. So I really like that. It sounds great on bass too. It will sound great on other things too, but it's one of my new favorite compressors. And it's not that expensive, so check that out, the JST Finality. Number eight is another old favorite, the DBX-160. Once again, on drums, it's hard to beat the aggression that you get. And I'm talking mostly kick and snare. So what'll happen is you set it so it's only about a 2-to-1 ratio. It doesn't have to be high. It actually sounds better if the ratio is low. And again, you don't need to compress that much, just a few dB, but boy, it adds punch. It really just works. And again, this is another one of those things that works on everything. Something about many of these old devices that it's really hard to replace them. And again, I'm talking about the hardware and the software versions of all these things. Number nine is the Fairchild 660 and 670. Well, you can put these on a drum bus. You can put it on an individual channel. And again, it adds a color. There's no other compressor that sounds like it. Most people like to use it on the mix bus, and I do too. It'll add a certain glue. There are some times where it doesn't seem appropriate to me. Other people use it all the time, other mixers, but that's not the case for me. I'm pretty careful how I use it, although I used to use it much more before I went to the combination of the Vintage Warmer and the SSL. Number 10, the Distressor. This is one of the modern compressors that actually stands out and that's very different from everything else. Thankfully, there's now a software version. And the software version has a few more parameter controls than the hardware version, but this is one of those compressors that always sounds good on what you're using it, although you can really set it up to make it sound bad too if you're not careful. But once you get your settings down, it's terrific for tracking vocals, for instance. And I'll put this on many times as a limiter that will just take care of a few of the peaks. So in other words, it's just pulling a dB or two, but it really does make a difference on a singer sometimes. And if a singer gets really loud and out of control, it's there. It's fast enough to take control of the situation. Honorable mention is the Pro Tools Native DigiRack Compressor. I find this works really well when I need a lot of compressors and I'm running out of horsepower, because the Pro Tools compressor doesn't really take much horsepower. It's very easy on the computer. So you can put a ton of these in, and really you can make it sound great because there's plenty of parameter control over this. It doesn't work really well as a limiter. You can set it up to work as a limiter, but it's not really great for that. But it's really great as a compressor, and I use it all the time. I'm not afraid to go to it if there's nothing else available. So these are my latest top 10 compressor favorites. I did this because these are the compressors that I use every day. I think about 3 years ago, I actually posted something about this on my blog, and many of them are still the same, and a few have dropped off, mostly because I don't use them anymore. One is the Neve 33609, for instance, which I used to use a lot more than I do now. The hardware version is great. The software version works pretty well, too. But I find that I'm not using it as much as some of the others on the list. So for better or for worse, these are my top 10 favorite compressors. Michael Carey started his career as a guitar player, but soon found his way into writing music for commercials. His credits include Toyota, Ford, Sonic, Coke, Papa John's, NASCAR, Exxon, and Outback, among others, as well as on-air promo packages for CBS, NBC, and TBS. Michael missed album work, though, and has since made his way back into songwriting, production, and session work, and he'll tell you about that journey in the upcoming interview. I spoke with Michael from a studio in Woodland Hills, California, via Skype. Tell me how you got started in this crazy business that we're in.
Crazy business. Well, there wasn't any sort of great plan. As a kid, I started playing guitar, and by the time I was in my early teens, I started taking it more seriously and playing in bands. And you know, had a good friend back in those days who's gone on to do some pretty cool things himself. But we were sort of like this little gruesome twosome, these sort of precocious kids who were playing, you know, in sort of a higher level, you know, cover bands, top 40 bands in the area, you know, doing 5 night a week gigs in nightclubs or whatever. So high school was like, that's just what I did during the day. But, you know, the real education for me was coming at night, you know, playing 40, 50 songs a night. And, you know, with guys who were 10, 15 years older. And kind of when I discovered I could make money doing that, I never really considered anything else. So gigs got better. By the time I was 18, I was in a band that got signed. We made a record. We toured a little bit. Band ultimately, you know, that didn't pan out, but it introduced me to the studio, which was another mind-opening thing. So by the time I was 19 or 20, you know, I'd done a couple of these things and had a taste of what was possible. And I was always drawn to sounds. As a guitarist, you know, absolutely playing and tone and touch and technique and finding the right part. That was all important, but the sonics of it really captivated me. And so getting in the studio and seeing how sounds were captured, how things were recorded, that made an impression early on. Even a few years before I actually started doing anything about it, I always paid attention to that. So I think that planted the seeds for ultimately which, you know, where I ended up going.
Where are you from, by the way?
Born in Chicago. Family moved to Southern California when I was 6. So San Diego. High school years were in Palm Springs, which is kind of an interesting place to grow up. There were a lot of, actually, at the time, a lot of nightclubs and so, you know, places to play. And there was a whole, still is, I think, a whole sort of inland empire circuit of really good musicians, especially in the sort of soul, funk, R&B category, which is a lot of what I did at the time. You know, it was a pretty fertile environment with a lot of great influences you know, people that I looked up to and opportunities to play.
Okay, you're 20 years old and now you're past the band and you're getting more into what's happening in the studio. So then what?
Well, I was still playing cover bands at night. I mean, that was just, you know, making you know, a few hundred bucks a week, which at the time was sort of a living wage-ish. And I looked around. I was still sort of the kid in the band, but everybody else was now kind of getting to the point where it was clear that was their path. They were going to do that as long as those gigs were available. And I started to look around, and that didn't look like a great path ahead. It was great school. It was a great opportunity, younger, but it became clear to me that it was important to start writing. It was important to start learning studio craft and getting more onto that side of things. And to be, I guess I would put it in today's terms, a content creator, as opposed to a hired gun, because you're always at the mercy of the next gig. Or if you do have a great gig with a steady artist and they decide they want to grow broccoli for a year, it's not, that doesn't bode well for your livelihood. I was starting to get interested in those things. And so I took some courses, orchestration and arranging, some music business courses, some production courses, started an original band, with my brother, who, has gone on to make some pretty cool records as well as a producer. We started approaching it that way, as opposed to being just a musician for hire. And along the way, there was a photographer / video director who was working with our then band, a guy named Moshe Braca, who was starting to do commercials. And Moshe had shot like a bunch of Rolling Stone covers and was a pretty iconic photographer in the 80s. And he started to direct commercials. He didn't like the music that the ad agencies were putting up against his picture. He was a real innovative artiste, really, and I'm not being facetious when I use that term with him. He was a real artistic visionary, and he really had a concept for how he wanted his spots to work. And having just worked with our band, having a vibe for our sound and sensibilities, he called me up and he said, "Dude, I need you guys to come out to New York and, replace this cheesy music with something that's got, as he said, some sex to it." So it was just, kind of 0 to 60 in 0 seconds flat, in the sense that, I had never really done any scoring for picture or anything like that. But we kind of got the hang of the technical stuff, already had small demo rigs. At the time it was still linear tape. So, Porta Studios basically. Mm-hmm. And brought some gear with us to New York, and knocked out like 10 commercials in the space of a month or so. And realized, wow, money's pretty good. We can buy better gear, because that was, the cycle. Get money, buy gear. Get money, buy gear. Invest in ourselves that way. And it led to, this kind of serendipitous falling into that field, where if you do it for a while, if you can stay in the game, you start to get pretty good at it. And I built a client base and did some pretty high profile work. And really enjoyed a lot of it. And at the same time, wrestled at times thinking, wow, this wasn't the lane that I had intended to get into. But, life moves on. At this point, I had a young, got married. We had a child on the way, and I was making a living. And so I stayed connected to the album side of things, playing sessions when I could. Every year or so, I'd do like an indie album, or I produce an international artist, and I really kept my connection to songs and studio craft, more the long form, like record side of things, alive. But I was making for about 10 or 15 years almost exclusively, the better share of my income was coming from doing music for picture, mostly commercials. That's a long answer to a short question.
Okay, well, I'm curious. So how long have you been doing commercials, been composing for commercials?
First one I did was in 1987.
Okay.
And so I'm still, I guess we're going on 3 decades.
Good. That actually makes my question more valid, I think. What is the difference in what you do between now and when you first started? Are there big differences?
There are massive differences. When you ask what is the difference in what I do, are you speaking specifically with respect to commercials or just in general?
Well, let's just talk about commercials first.
Okay. First of all, for me, at least in my experience, the landscape and the music for commercials environment has changed significantly. And my path was a little bit unusual. So I don't know if this applies globally, but I'll talk about my experience. Fairly early on, by the mid 90s, I was operating more as sort of a boutique, small production company. And I had a small roster of insanely loyal clients who kept me really, really busy. All the brands that fell under the Outback Steakhouse parent corporation. I was doing all their TV and radio stuff for quite a long time, and a few other ad agencies where I had, you know, great relationships with the creative directors there, and they knew what I could do. And a lot of what I got called to do was stuff that sounded like it came from a legitimate album, you know, a rock band, a pop band, something that didn't sound like a commercial knockoff or a jingle or whatever. I've done my share of those too, and they're fun, but that was a lot of what I got called to do. And at the time, it's because the stuff that if they had their druthers, they would have been getting was unlicensable. It was either too expensive or the bands or the artists didn't want to license their music for a commercial. They didn't want the sort of, the stain of selling out to besmirch their reputation. That has changed.
Yeah, no kidding.
As I'm sure you're sure, but there was still this mentality at the time that it would diminish an artist's credibility if they licensed their music for commercials. By the time we hit the early 2000s, that was really starting to change. You know, Madonna, Sting, these Led Zeppelin for Cadillac, these iconic artists were licensing their music for commercials. And I think there's a direct correlation between diminishing album sales revenue and the need for record companies to find other ways to monetize music. And there was a changing of the guard just generationally with the sort of mindset of music consumers, where that earlier sort of, oh, you're selling out mentality, that was a kind of leftover from the 60s and 70s, I think. And now you had new generations of people who had just no association with that whatsoever. And they just said, you know, if they heard something cool in a commercial, well, that was cool music. Let's go to iTunes and find it. Or, you know, let's go to Napster and grab it. Or, you know, at the time, whatever the case, it was just another valid way to expose people to music. And so that changed things. Over time, over the next several years, music that was previously unlicensable, that I would be hired to create something that had a certain sound or a similar effect or, you know, would serve that purpose and sound like it came, you know, music inspired by, you could call it that, because we didn't want to get close enough to get people sued. We didn't want to do a direct knockoff, but it had that character. Increasingly, it became more affordable to license the stuff that I had previously been hired to create something similar to. And production music, which used to be sort of an anathema to ad agency creatives, it was getting better. And there was increasingly a mentality of sort of bottom line driven. So is this brilliant? Does it sound as great as something that we would pay, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to have custom composed for us? No. Is it good enough? Yeah. And does it cost us a tenth of, you know, what our previous music budgets would have been? Yeah. Okay, let's go. And I think the style of editing, the way TV content was being produced with the increase of reality television, were just, you know, editors, avid editors, instead of dedicated music editors, would just be grabbing slugs of production music or whatever was available to make an otherwise static piece of picture have a pulse and a beat. That was being adopted more and more on the commercial field. So long story short, market is much more saturated now in terms of people willing to do the work for much, much less. And the, you know, with some exceptions, the budgets are generally smaller. And, you know, the competition now is so saturated that just arithmetically the odds are not as great. And there used to be demo fees, and quite often there aren't now. So it really has become much more crowdsourced and speculative. And for me, that used to be kind of my day job. And now it's not really the whole dynamics of that environment are less suited for that. Around 2008, when the crash happened and all these things sort of came to a head simultaneously, I had sort of a existential moment and said, you know, maybe this is time for me to sort of blindly go after what I've always loved, which is songwriting and production and album stuff. And it was, you know, just a complete, it's an insane move in the sense that, you know, it's not like the record industry is such a sure deal in terms of steady income as well. But I had worked my whole life and had been driven by a passionate pursuit of songs and sounds and creating work that had an emotional impact, that I figured if I didn't just go for it gung-ho at this point, I would be that bitter guy years from now saying I would have, should have, could have. And I didn't want to be that. So I did and you know, cultivated relationships more on that end of things. And I had had some, but, you know, I needed to expand my contacts and sort of make a name for myself in that world. And a few years later, I've got some things now that I'm pretty proud of. And you know, I can say, yeah, I do this now. So the interesting thing about this journey is that I've had to learn to wear a lot of different hats, and all of them really come into play in everything that I do now. And it's probably, you know, I think you could probably relate to this as well, Bobby. You need to know how to do more than just one thing.
Yeah, and I think it's really important, especially if you're a songwriter, that your demo sounds as close to the finished product as it can, which is, again, diametrically opposed to the way it used to be, where I can remember publishers saying, all I want is a guitar and vocal or a piano and vocal. That's it. I can hear through it, which was completely wrong. They couldn't hear through it when it was all said and done. But now, you know, you're kind of forced to be a really good producer and an engineer and a good songwriter and a good player and everything else in between, just so you can get in the game.
Yeah, no, absolutely. If you're doing anything where, you know, there's competition involved, where multiple people are pitching, you have to play to win. You have to, and it's become much more like this on the sort of music for picture front as well. Basically, you have to make the final as your demo.
Yeah.
You have to make that something that's air ready, you know, released ready, or as close, as damn close to possible, you know, as possible to that. There are very few exceptions. There are a couple of there are a couple of producers where, when they work with certain bands or certain artists, they tap a certain pool of writers to submit material or to work with those artists to strengthen their material. And one of those in particular, I've gotten some cuts, you know, with the artist that this guy has produced, and he's one of the few people who can hear through a very bare bones demo that I've experienced. You know, he's a great producer. He's made a lot of, you know, really big records. His name is Howard Benson.
Oh, sure.
And So, and Howard and his wife Monica Benson, who is an independent publisher, you know, they've got a core group of writers that they call upon, you know, to submit material and, you know, if there's a good fit, work with the artists. And, you know, I've had some great experiences doing some of those things. And Howard can hear through a raw demo. As a matter of fact, it's all, you know, in that one exception that I've heard, it's almost better to keep things like more minimal and let him really hear the song and melody. He's got.
Wow. So do you consider yourself a songwriter now, more of a songwriter than anything?
I'm going to say I do consider myself a songwriter, and I've gotten some traction that way, but I make more of my living as a producer, as a session player, and as a person who provides certain production services to other producers. Increasingly I'm doing a lot of, people will send me you know, tracks or entire albums in need of guitars. So I'll receive a Pro Tools session minus, you know, the guitars that I'm going to put on, and I landscape it. And my studio is really well equipped for that. Great amps, great heads, great cabinets in my live room, dedicated signal chains. So I can call up the right sounds, you know, create the tracks and send off mix ready stuff where the song is just pretty much fleshed out. And so I do that for other producers. And the thing is, I think that the dynamics of just back end royalties are just way different now than they were even just a few years ago. And so, yes, I'm a songwriter, but in terms of generating immediate income, and I'm assuming for the people who are tuned into your blog, a lot of this is about, you know, generating work and, you know, practical stuff. I still do a lot of work for hire.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what you got to do. There's not too many people that can really not afford to do that anymore. As you say, the royalty scheme has changed so much that it just makes it really difficult to rely on that anymore as an income stream, as a single income stream. So, you know, we all do multiple things in order to get by. That's the new reality, I think.
Yeah. And I love production. I mean, I would put that right on par with songwriter. It's kind of, and if I get a TV show or a soundtrack song, I've done, you know, a few end title tracks, main title tracks for films, and soundtrack things where it's a writing assignment where you're writing something that fits the mood of the film, and you're creating a track that sonically is appropriate for that emotional tone and the impact that you want to create. That's kind of where these different disciplines converge, where, you know, there's an element of composition, but there's definitely an element of songwriting because I'm doing the lyrics as well as the, you know, the music, and absolutely, absolutely production, because that's how you make it sound the way you do and capture the performances from the musicians or singer or what have you. And so it's hard to say I'm more this or that. You know, but that's a huge part of what I do is production.
Yeah.
Because that's at the end of the day, anything, you know, any of the other hats that you wear, at the end of the day, that's how you package it. That's how you execute it and deliver it.
Okay, so let's get geeky for a second. You talked about how your studio is set up for you to do guitars, and you have dedicated signal chains and everything. So lay it on me. What do you got?
All right. So, well, here, I'm going to... let's see if we can, I'm not sure you can see those guys from here. This is odd because I'm pointing my webcam. You can see there's a little sort of tower of heads there. My main, and there are a few choice goodies there.
Oh,
1950s Premier, a beautiful 1964 pre-CBS Fender Princeton. Just a couple of the goodies here that I work with. I just, after a long time using plugins when I was really more active on the commercial front, where, you know, at that point it's you're just cranking. Your turnaround time is maybe 2 days from the time you get the brief to the time you send off the elements. And so, you know, the amp modelers within Pro Tools were my friend very much. You know, I would amp farm things quite a bit just because, you know, I hadn't really put the time into setting up my real stuff. And the prospect of miking an amp and getting the right sound, and maybe if I want to get a different sound, repeating the process, it just seemed kind of daunting logistically when I was on such a tight deadline. But at a certain point, it just started getting less inspiring as a guitarist. So, and even for tracks where it wasn't all about the guitar, just, you know, that's sort of where I started. And it's a thing that I do on almost everything that I produce. It's just easier for me to grab a guitar, and, you know, that becomes a big part of the texture of the track more often than not. And so at one point I said, you know, I've got a couple of down days. I'm going to set up my heads in the control room. I'm going to set up my cabs, you know, a few beautiful cabs in the live room. I've got an oversized 2x12 slant cab that's loaded with Scumbag H, what are they? Those are H50s. So the Scumbag makes some of the most incredible pre-roll of Celestian clones, and I'm hooked on those things. Mm-hmm. They're so expressive and just so sort of thick and chewy, and they really give you like the best of, you know, what a head has to offer. And so that is the cabinet that does most of the heavy lifting as far as straight guitar tones. I've got a beautiful Leslie Model 16, mic'd up from Red Crow, open back little 1x12 pine cabinet that's great for Fendery sounds, and then a little pine Marshall Bluesbreakers cab, just like a little 1x12 loaded with, it's a Scumnico, it's an Elnico made by Scumbag. And so it's a great kind of like early 60s, you know, boutique-y little, you know, open back Marshall combo kind of vibe. So all those guys are mic'd up, ready to go. Usually there's a 57 and a 421 that are just positioned for, you know, optimum phase right next to each other. And those guys, they're sitting kind of, imagine this is the dust cap in the center of the speaker. These guys are kind of like right where the cone of the speaker meets the dust cap. So you get that sort of the warmth of the cone, but the definition of the center. And then I've got a big old ribbon mic that's also positioned fairly close on one of the other speakers. And all those guys are going through dedicated mic pre's. These days I'm using, I've got several channels of handmade pre called Sebatron. It's made in Australia. It's all to Class A, really great tone shaping capabilities. Short of an actual, you know, adjustable EQ, there are high and low adjustments and flat adjustments, and you can dial in how hard you hit the tube on the front end and how hot your output is. And so with those controls, you can really get like a beautifully transparent tone, or you can get a really saturated tone. And so I've got like six channels of that happening on several of the cabs, some Neve 1272s, some Jim Williams audio upgrades, high-speed mic pre's, which are just like bare wire.
Yeah.
And those are actually on the dynamics on my main cab, on the 57 and the 429. They're just so smooth and open. You get, it's just really pleasing. It's not brittle or hard at all. So those come in on auxes in any Pro Tools session. I've got sort of a, you know, guitar tracking template that I'll import session data into whatever session that I'm working on. And there are my inputs. And essentially, I've got it streamlined now to the point where it's as fast as bringing up a plugin. I plug into the head that I want, plug that into the speaker cable that feeds the cab that I want in there, the appropriate, you know, activate the appropriate channels of incoming, you know, mic pre on the auxes, and I route those. If it's a mono track, I will mix, I won't print the mic separately if it's a mono track. I'll commit going on the way into the balance of mics, ribbon versus dynamics, 57 versus 421. I'll get the sound that I want that makes me happy at that moment, because on the back end, I don't want to be making those decisions.
Yeah.
I want a sound that makes me happy now and commit and print. And likewise, you know, with the Leslie, I don't print the Leslie alone. There's always some of the straight cab mixed in, because that's where you get the definition. It's almost too swirly and, you know, when it's just the Leslie alone. But if you mix in maybe about 30 to 40% of, you know, a straight cab as well, and I'm driving both with any given head when I use Leslie, that's where you get the beautiful sort of definition and fullness and that chorusing that happens between the unmodulated sound and the modulated Leslie. That's where you get the thickness and the satisfying Leslie sound that I love so much. So there you go.
Yeah.
I print like, and what I found, Bobby, is that it is so much more satisfying, and you can fill space in a track with a single part that's kind of economical, or, you know, elegant, if you will. Just, you don't have to play as much. You don't have to double or layer as much, sometimes not at all. A single part that's the right part, the right sound, where you're actually catching the real thing. Molecules of air bumping into each other through hot iron and tubes going into your rig, it just speaks. It's got weight, it's got substance and character, and you can move on then.
Yeah, I want to go back to where you talked before about having a deadline that was really quick. So you had a quick turnaround. So you felt that you needed to use the plugins at that point. How quick was that turnaround?
A leisurely turnaround would be 4 or 5 days. A really fast turnaround would be 24, 48 hours. Typically, it's somewhere in the middle. As time went by, and as I cultivated better relationships with people higher up in the production chain or execution chain at ad agencies, I found myself participating more from the inception stage of a part where they were thinking proactively involving music, or if it was a music-driven spot, I was often tapped for the lyrics for that. And so, that brought me into the sort of creation of messaging for that particular spot. And in those cases, they were really great, just in the sense that it wasn't just this afterthought that was tagged on after the picture. So I would have more lead time then. I could anticipate what was when the production actually started. I had more time to work with. But typically, yeah, really fast, less than a week.
I saw on your webpage that you did a lot of on-air promos.
Yeah. Yeah. And most of those were a while back. Did some for CBS. More recently, TBS and Turner, and for a couple of, for the network in general, and specifically for some shows. Several packages, sort of identity packages, for a show called Dinner and a Movie, which is sort of like their Friday night movie. So a couple of successive iterations of that, where the theme, the sort of bumpers, stingers, and music that goes underneath the host as they're talking, about the movie and so on and so forth. So yeah, those were fun. Those were really cool.
How are they different from doing commercials? Do you have more time, less time? Did you have more direction? Less direction.
Commercials, because you're working in such a condensed time frame, the budgets can be so much bigger. It's incredibly crucial that every single moment counts. You don't have the luxury to set a mood and create the setting and build into something or whatever. It's like, from 0 seconds to 3 seconds, you're setting the stage. From 3 seconds to 10 seconds, you're creating, you're underscoring what the problem is or the conflict is. By the middle of the spot, it reaches a climax. And then, by the last, 10 seconds or so, resolution, and then some sort of memorable, outro theme that hits the client's mnemonic or whatever. And so you've got this incredibly tight structure where there's just no room for any fat. In on-air promos and structures like that, you're not hitting so many marks with such intensity. So it's more about creating a mood. If there is an existing mnemonic that you've got to use and say update or incorporate into it, you figure out how to do that gracefully. Your mission is different. It's more about creating something that hopefully becomes familiar, that becomes enjoyable, that sets off a cue for the listener. Oh, it's this show. This is that cool show that I want to, watch and be a part of. And it's something that draws the listener in because it's familiar and inviting. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it does. Very cool. All right. Last question for you, cause I don't want to take up too much of your time. What's the best piece of business advice, or music business advice, or even music advice that you've received from somebody along the way, or maybe you learned yourself?
That's a tough one, Bobby. There are a lot of good people who have graciously imparted a lot of wisdom. In the interest of offering something pertinent for your followers, I recently was speaking with an interesting, very, very, uh, accomplished guy named Scott Page.
Oh, sure. Who, I know Scott. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and Scott is sort of a futurist and a person who makes it a good point to sort of survey the landscape and see what applies in terms of business models now. And he's you know, obviously a great musician, and he's got a long and storied musical past. But I think the sort of 500-pound gorilla that's in the room for all of us is the fact that the dynamics of making a living in the music business have changed so radically. And so the things that so many of my colleagues and myself as well, one of the biggest challenges that we face is that, you know, we've spent our lives getting good at a certain thing and pursuing our passion and making everything that we do sort of a you know, trying to beat the last thing that we did, you know, up our game. And yet at the same time, the economics of the industry and the sort of increasing sort of crowdsourcing spec nature of stuff that we used to do reliably as work for hire. And even on the songwriting side, you know, the diminishing back end royalties. If you're doing this professionally, there are things that one can do to market oneself effectively. And we really do have to think of ourselves as businesses and apply those business principles to what it is that we do and figure out what is your strong suit? What do you have to offer? How can you then speak to the people who need what it is that you do best, what distinguishes you? How can you communicate with them, start those conversations, demonstrate what you have to offer? For all the commercial stuff and the sort of discipline proved to be really valuable when I started getting more into the songwriting and production side of things. And for a long time, I had been apologetic about doing music for commercials, like things that I should have been proud of, you know, Coca-Cola and Exxon and Ford and, you know, beers and cars and steaks and, you know, like these really high profile things. But I was kind of grumbling inside saying, well, but I'm not making records that I want to be making and whatever. And this is, I'm selling out and all that. And it's just, you know what, later on all that, I was doing high quality work with high quality people. And I learned skills and disciplines that were so applicable when I started doing, you know, focusing more on record work. And at the same time, because I'd always stayed in touch with things stylistically and, you know, kept a foot in that with sessions or whatever, that brought a certain contemporary sensibility to the commercial work. And so those things now, I look at work as work. And what is the nature? What's the target? I don't draw lines between commercial or TV or album or songwriting. What's the mission? How can we make the best thing that we can? How can we create the strongest emotional impact for the listener? If I'm producing an artist, how can I create the environment where they can dig in deep and feel like, yeah, this is the defining statement I want to make? At the end of the day, it's kind of cutting through all the other BS or sort of technicalities and getting to that point of emotional impact, emotional connection, making the statement that you want to make, because every piece of work that you do is going to be sort of the thing that defines you until the next piece of work that you do.
To find out more info on Michael, you can go to michaelcarey.com. It's Michael Carey, C-A-R-E-Y, all one word, michaelcarey.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go to bobbyownercircle.com or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyownercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.